Before we start, please note that this podcast features sexually explicit content and descriptions of violence and crime. Over a century ago, Lancaster was a wide-open city for prostitution, liquor, and gambling, otherwise known as vice. City officials tolerated and even encouraged these activities. Police knew where the brothels were, but instead of shutting them down, they socialized with sex workers. The mayor himself was known as a live wire, whose philosophy was live and let live. In fact, there were several well-known gambling games within a stone's throw of his office. That all started to change in 1913, when four detectives came from New York and Rhode Island to Lancaster for an undercover investigation of vice. They were from the American Vigilance Association, which was an organization dedicated to eliminating prostitution across the country. These investigators left behind their accounts of their travels through Lancaster's hotel lobbies, alleys, bars, and brothels. They wrote detailed notes about their conversations with brothel keepers, who were also known as madams, waiters, sex workers, and bellboys. Their papers include 750 typed pages, photographs of sex workers and their houses, drawings of the layouts of brothels, and sex workers' calling cards. In addition, a local anti-vice agent who was not undercover kept copies of his handwritten notes about gambling, obscenity, commercial sex, and drinking in 10-bound books spanning 1913 to 1917. These typed reports and handwritten books make up the Vice Files. Our goal for each episode is to introduce you to a person we have encountered in these unpublished files. The Vice Files often reveal secrets that a person hid from public view, or simply details considered too trivial for news reports. But these details help us to reconstruct a person's struggles and motivations, their sorrows and success. To us, these files are more than details about places and activities. They reveal people who wouldn't ordinarily make it into the history books, or onto markers or monuments. It is worth getting to know them because they show how seemingly ordinary people navigated legal, political, and economic challenges, and how vice fit into people's everyday lives of work and play. Here's how each episode works. First, we present a profile of our featured person using public records, mainly newspapers from their lifetime, but also census records and court documents. The rest of the episode will focus on what the unpublished Vice Files reveal about the person. Meet Barbara Foreman, waitress and widow. The first substantial account of Barbara Foreman in public records is the announcement of her death in 1941. Her obituary in the local Lancaster newspapers reports that she is only 46 years old, the widow of Edward Johnson. Her parents, George, who worked in a brewery, and Lizzie were still living, as were her six siblings. When she died, she was working at Hildy's, a bar on North Mary Street. She boarded at a house on Mulberry Street, where she had lived for 2 years. The obituary listed the cause of her death as a heart attack, but her death certificate explained that the heart attack was a result of acute alcoholism. Her published obituary did not give her race, as readers presumed whiteness unless the newspaper noted otherwise. Her death certificate, however, listed her race as white. This is not much information, but it is enough to offer a rough outline of who she was. At the end of her life, she was a white, wage-earning woman living on her own, probably suffering from alcoholism. There is one other intriguing mention of Barbara Foreman, however. In 1929, one Lancaster paper noted that Mrs. Barbara Johnson of New York was a guest at her sister's birthday party. At some point, it seems, Barbara Foreman Johnson got out of Lancaster and lived in New York City. How long did she live there? Did she meet her husband there? We don't know. By 1935, she was back in Lancaster, living on Mulberry Street, where she died. The brief obituary and the description of the birthday party leave out so much. We learn nothing about the rest of her life, what led to that rooming house on Mulberry Street, or to Hildy's Bar. The unpublished files, the records of the anti-vice investigators, give a fuller picture of Foreman as a young woman. Let's open the Vice files and meet Barbara Foreman, charity girl and tobacco wrapper. We first encounter Barbara Foreman in Paul Kinsey's description of meeting her in a front of a movie theater on King Street on November 18th after 9:30 p.m. Kinsey was an undercover investigator sent to Lancaster by the American Vigilance Association to study commercial sex in Lancaster. From New York City, Kinsey was only 24 at the time of the month-long investigation. He was close to Barbara Foreman's age. She had turned 19 a few months before they met. Kinsey, a University of Kentucky graduate, was known as an expert on disguises, and he went on to high-profile work, including an investigation of prostitution for the League of Nations in the 1920s. Kinsey's career eventually took him all over the country, Chicago, Honolulu, Miami. Barbara Foreman was born and raised in Lancaster, and after a short interlude in New York, this is where she died. Paul Kinsey first met Barbara on a Tuesday night, November 18th, in 1913. Barbara was standing in front of the Reno Movie Theater on West King Street. A romantic adventure, The Hidden Treasure Ranch, was playing at the Reno. In this movie, treasure hunters fall in love with two women at the ranch. One poster for the movie shows men on horseback. Another image is of men with rifles around a campfire surrounded by mountains. For Barbara, the movie promised much more of what she craved, an adventure far from her home and a passionate love affair. She was admiring the scenes on a movie poster, likely from the Hidden Treasure Ranch, when she drew the passing Paul Kinsey, a stranger, into conversation.
That's just what I love to do, pose for the movies. A girl who has a job like that is in pretty soft. Don't you think so?
I'm sure I don't know. I never was a girl.
I know that, but all kidding aside, you know they get big money and have good times. It's no use talking. Some folks have got all kinds of luck.
Evidently, you're dissatisfied with your present status.
If you mean position, I surely am. When I see what other people get, I ain't jealous, but still you know how it is. I guess it's no use kicking. What the hell? I ain't so bad off after all.
You're rather a funny girl. First, you're dissatisfied, and then you're satisfied. Do you really know what you want?
I know what I want, all right, but you can't give it to me.
That's true enough, until I know what you want.
I know what you're thinking I want. Well, it ain't that at all. I get all of that I want. What I want is to get out of Lancaster and get to New York.
This exchange gives us insights into Barbara Foreman. She dreamed of escaping her job and escaping Lancaster. When Kinsey asks what she wants, he assumes she wants a date. Instead, Barbara rejects him. She didn't want or need him exactly, because she gets all of the men she wants anyway. When they met again later, Kinsey learned more about her present status. She earned between $6 and $8 per week at the Federal Cigar Factory. Her income varied because she was paid per piece.
$6 per week was below the livable minimum wage of $6.50,
which Reverend Clifford Twombly had calculated after an investigation into working conditions for women. Twombly, the rector of St. James Episcopal Church in the center of downtown Lancaster, advocated higher wages for working women as one way to discourage women from entering prostitution. He lobbied the state to pass a minimum wage for women, but this effort failed. Paul Kinsey identified Barbara Foreman as a charity girl, a wage-earning woman who exchanged sex for tickets to shows, restaurant meals, or consumer goods. A charity girl was also known as a treating girl because she accepted treating in exchange for sex. Young wage-earning women worked in the department stores, candy stores, and cafes, and in the tobacco industry, umbrella factory, and silk mills. But they needed dates to help them access the exciting nightlife and the attractive consumer goods that surrounded them downtown. So, Some of them used sex to get what they wanted. But they drew a line that prostitutes did not. Charity girls did not accept cash. Charity girls viewed dating as bartering, a practice that became more popular as the 20th century progressed. Charity girls dressed more modestly than prostitutes and did not wear heavy paint or powder, but they made an impact on street life as they walked in pairs and boldly flirted with passing men. Reformers were alarmed at the high number and the high visibility of the charity girls around the city. Charity girls did not consider themselves prostitutes, but they shared Lancaster streets, restaurants, and hotel lobbies with them. The Reno Theater, where Barbara Forman met Paul Kinsey, was in Lancaster's entertainment and retail district in the center of the city. Just a few doors down was the Antis Cafe, and across the street was the Hager's Department Store and the Hotel Majestic. This area of town was not the red light district. That was a few blocks away on Water Street and Mifflin Street. But the cafes, theaters, and hotels in this neighborhood played an important supporting role in the sex trade. Sex workers met their customers in hotel lobbies, cafes, and on the street. Charity girls flirted and met their dates here too. These investigators saw charity girls teetering dangerously on the edge of vice. The slightest mishap or temptation could cause them to fall into full-fledged prostitution, or as they called it, professional prostitution. Paul Kinsey was clear with Barbara Forman when he told her he was worried about where her dating life would lead.
Many girls of your type, when the time came that money was needed, they all took the downward path. Take my advice and stay in Lancaster. You've got your folks here who will take care of you when in need. Because if you ever get away from home again and can't find a position, you know that the streets will be your first thought.
Kinsey and the other investigators in Lancaster in 1913 kept a separate file on charity girls, even though these young women had committed no crimes when they flirted or made dates. At least they had not yet committed any crimes. Kinsey concluded his record of his first conversation with Barbara Forman with this grim evaluation and prediction.
The general makeup of a girl indicates her as being an ill-bred, stubborn child. I am of the opinion that this type of girl properly shows the connection between the charity and the prostitute.
The rise of the charity girl in the city depended on women's increasing participation in wage labor and on the growth of commercial entertainment such as movie theaters. Both of these developments alarmed anti-vice reformers because they offered opportunities for unsupervised interaction between men and women. They put women at risk outside of the seeming safety of home. Historians estimate that in major cities, more than half of single women between the ages of 15 and 29 worked for wages around 1900. The rise in wage-earning women increased across immigrant and racial lines among the working class. These wage-earning women earned less than men did and often gave their pay to their families, so they had little cash for themselves. Thus, while they gained confidence in their employment and freedom to be out on the streets alone, they had little money for themselves. At the same time, commercial amusements such as movie theaters and dance halls grew in popularity. Movies, dance halls, and other popular theaters featured erotic content such as skimpy costumes, risque dances, and sexual innuendos. And the venues offered space for unsupervised, mixed-sex interactions. Women of all classes needed male escorts to attend many theaters and restaurants. On top of that, working-class women needed money for those tickets. Finding a date was thus a necessity. The charity girl's desire for spending money may seem frivolous, but if you imagine the ways their lives were constrained by work and family, six-day work weeks, parents, siblings, or children of their own to support, the importance of having public entertainment as an outlet may start to make more sense. At the end of their first conversation, Barbara gave Paul a calling card with her address, 43 Washington Street. He didn't think much of this address until another investigator on the team told him that he had heard about a brothel at that very address, 43 Washington Street. Paul set out to find Barbara the next day. First, he went to her place of employment, the Federal Cigar Factory, but she had not shown up for work that day. Then he went to the Washington Street address. He found her in the parlor. Paul and Barbara seemed surprised to see the other person.
Barbara had insisted she was not a prostitute, but here she was, lounging in a brothel. Barbara claimed that she had just arrived a few minutes ago with a friend, Marie, and that she was now leaving. Paul Kinsey tried to sort out the confusion by asking Barbara questions.
Do you know what kind of place you are in?
Yes, I do. But what's that got to do with me? I only went there with Marie. Because she's bad, I don't have to drop, do I? She's a friend of mine. We were brought up together, and I ain't gonna scratch her now.
I don't doubt that you dearly love her, but you must consider yourself in this case. If not, you can lose a good reputation by being seen in this house by some of your friends.
Well, she's a friend of mine, and I don't care I was over there the other night, and Marie went with six fellas while I was there. Just look, I've got to work a whole week for what she earns in a few hours.
Paul Kinsey again warned her that she would soon become a full-fledged prostitute like Marie. But Barbara held her ground. To her, it was simple. She liked having a good time with men, but not for cash.
I told you last night I like to go out with a fella and have a good time. Well, so I do. This slow place gets on my nerves after working all year like a slave. I think I'm entitled to see what other folks see. That's why I get sore now and then and get into scraps at home. I might say a lot and I might lie a lot. I like to brag and shoot the bull, but you could take this. Not as long as my folks are near will I ever go on like Marie.
Barbara Foreman weighed her options for getting out of a low-paying, dead-end job and an unhappy family situation. On one hand, she had hoped that a suitor would take her to New York City and marry her. She told Paul Kinsey that he was older than she was, 25 years old, and made a good salary. She believed he was nuts for her, and this was an appealing, romantic scenario for Barbara. To be rescued and supported by a husband who would take her away from her boring job in a boring city. But this man seemed to be delaying a marriage proposal, waiting until he got a job in New York City, according to Barbara. To urge him on, she planned to send him a love letter, which she shared with Paul Kinsey. At the end of the letter, she confessed to crying herself to sleep at night when she was away from him. Perhaps such an emotional appeal would sway him. Or maybe he was just stringing her along and had no intention of marrying her. Paul Kinsey even suggested that her sexual activity with multiple men in Lancaster would deter a marriage proposal. Kinsey said to Barbara Foreman, "Does your friend know you run around with other fellows?" Barbara seemed desperate in her pursuit of the suitor. She may have thought she was pregnant. She said to Kinsey, "You see, I'm all up in the air. You're lucky you're not a girl." Paul Kinsey did not address the gravity of her worries, the possibility of being pregnant outside of marriage, and instead he repeated his advice to stay with her parents and to stay close to home.
"If I was, you can wager that I'd stick to my parents in preference to anyone. If Lancaster was good enough for them, it surely is good enough for you."
Her family life, however, troubled Barbara Foreman. She said to Kinsey, "I'm always scrapping when I'm home, so my folks don't care a damn what becomes of me." She does not go more into detail about what the tensions were at home. The Vice files say no more about her home life. There are other clues to how families struggled over the behavior of daughters across the country when younger women went into the city to earn wages and came into contact with new men without adult supervision. Parents and sometimes brothers objected to young women's dating because it could challenge family honor. Any sign of promiscuity, real or imagined, presented a challenge. If a neighbor told parents that their daughter behaved improperly, the allegation alone could lead to a beating. Women's desire to date men they chose also upset the traditions of parents picking partners with economic concerns in mind. When young women prioritized love and adventure, they rejected parental control over their romantic lives. There were other types of disagreements also. Some parents expected their wage-earning daughters to give them most or all of their pay. Some young women resisted this. Living away from parents was hardly a solution, however, as the wage-earning woman now had to stretch her earnings to cover room and board. Barbara Foreman dreamed of escaping Lancaster with a fiancé. At the same time, a brothel keeper, May Snyder, presented another escape route.
Not out of Lancaster, but out of her dreary job in the tobacco factory, and out from under her father's rules. Paul Kinsey ran into Barbara Forman in front of the Fulton Opera House with brothel keeper May Snyder. Kinsey warned Barbara about May Snyder. She's working toward an end and you know it. Later, Barbara and Paul shared a meal with May at her brothel at 43 Washington Street. Barbara was already familiar with this house. She had been there several times with her friend Marie, who was working for May Snyder. Kinsey believed that May and Marie would succeed in recruiting Barbara.
No doubt, both May and Marie are trying by every possible means to induce Barbara to enter an immoral life. In my opinion, the girl is bound to yield, as she is of a fickle nature and does not know her own mind.
The investigators finished their work in Lancaster at the end of November in 1913. They left town and moved on to new investigations. This ended their effort to save Barbara Forman. At this point, Barbara's status was unclear. Was she a charity girl or a sex worker? Would Paul Kinsey's dire predictions come true? Kinsey offered no final confirmation. 2 years later, another investigator, John Klein, found Barbara Forman again. Klein worked as an agent for the Law and Order Society, which was a group of clergy, business leaders, and professors dedicated to getting rid of vice in Lancaster. The son of German immigrants, Klein was an independent Republican. Independent Republicans joined with Democrats to form a coalition that opposed the Republican city administration because it allowed vice to thrive. Some newspaper articles referred to him as the source of information about police corruption, which might have proved his worth to the Law and Order Society. Unlike Paul Kinsey and the other investigators on his team in 1913, Klein was not undercover. He monitored theaters, hotels, and brothels in plain view or from hiding spots across the street. He kept a daily record of his observations. Barbara Forman appeared in these records. Spying on a brothel at 831 Manor Street, Klein saw Forman and another woman enter the house on April 7th in 1915. Then he kept a list of all the men who came and went, including one black man. The agent learned that Barbara was living with May Snyder in a room at the Brinkman Hall on Orange Street. This room was known as a location for commercial sex. John Klein confirmed as much when he talked to a man at the Colonial Theater who said that
4 and 5 mornings of every week, different men leave Barbara Forman's room between 7 and 7:30 in the morning. On several occasions, men came over asking where the girls were.
By 1916, she was with May Snyder, working as a prostitute from a brothel on Manor Street, and then a furnished room at Brinkman's. She may have continued to work for wages during the day. Her marriage to Edward Johnson is mysterious. Her death certificate lists her as the widow of Edward Johnson, but we have not found any confirmation of their marriage. We have not located a marriage certificate. But we should not doubt her marriage because of her history and commercial sex. It was not unusual for charity girls or prostitutes to marry. Sometimes prostitutes hid their sex work from suitors, or they promised boyfriends that they would stop when they married. Working class boyfriends and parents did not judge commercial sexual exchanges as harshly as middle class reformers. For example, researchers at reform schools for delinquent girls found that many of the inmates married even though their fiancés knew they had been sentenced there because of their sexual activity. It is not even clear exactly when they married. Barbara Forman is listed as a cigar maker in Lancaster in the first half of the 1920s. Then, in 1929, the news of the family birthday party identifies her as Barbara Forman Johnson of New York. It is possible that she did spend several years in New York around this time, and perhaps married while she was there. Was her attendance at the birthday party a triumphant return to her hometown? Did she find the adventure she craved and some of the financial stability she needed when she made it up to New York City? Perhaps. But it now seems more likely that these aspirations were derailed. Maybe the time she spent in New York was marked by familiar struggles to get by. We recently uncovered one important clue about her life in New York City. We found her application for Social Security in 1936. On this application, she listed her residence as New York City. Her employer was the Emil Klein Cigar Company.
she was still a cigar maker. Later, she was back in Lancaster, living alone in the Mulberry Street rooming house. Whether in New York City or Lancaster, she hadn't gotten far. The unpublished Vice Files give a glimpse into one part of Barbara Forman's life. When she was a young single woman who was seeking a way out of the drudgery of the cigar factory and out of her parents' tense household. She wanted independence from her family, and she fantasized about the wider world outside of Lancaster. At every turn, her search for a better life depended on finding a man who would take her to New York City, men who would take her out to a show after a long workday, and then, men who would pay her for sex. For Barbara Forman, like many other working-class women, independence was elusive. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please listen to the other episodes of The Vice Files about Amanda Brenneman, Notorious Madam, and Kennedy Eckert, Young Sport. You can also learn more about these topics by taking the Lancaster Vice walking tour through the city. This podcast was created by Allison Kibler and a team of students from Franklin and Marshall College, Jaden LeCoe, Kylie Lochney, Rachel Rubens, and Dylan Sykes. Hope Glidden provided genealogical research. Narration by Rachel Rubens.